This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
The Norris Group proudly presents our 14th annual award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. Industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss evolving industry trends, real estate bubbles, inflation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Paul Herrera. Paul serves as an advocate for realtors and their clients on local issues, helping to preserve and protect property rights and value of home ownership. Working with colleagues at the California Association of Realtors and the National Association of Realtors, Paul helps members make a difference for their clients at a local, state, and federal level. His unique experience includes an award-winning journalism career with newspapers in Florida and California, where he covered real estate, small business, the aviation business, and the confluence of government policy, politics, and business. His coverage of real estate and growth in Florida earned him top honors from the Florida Press Club in 2002. In 2004, he won first place for in-depth business writing for the California Newspaper Publishers Association. After journalism, Paul served as communications director for San Bernardino County Economic Development Agency, coordinating everything from press outreach to speeches and video production. In 4 years with the agency, he oversaw our external communications, managed a communications team, and helped public position on a variety of projects and initiatives. The combination of mass media experience, local experience, policy, and political background and understanding of real estate issues prepared him to lead Ivar's government affairs and communication efforts through coalition building, strong messaging, and technical understanding. Paul earned a bachelor's of journalism degree from the University of Missouri Columbia. And we've had talk with him many times. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you, Bruce. By the way, that Florida Press Club Award, the thing I'm most proud about is the night of the award ceremony was Angels Game 6 against the Giants. I walked out of the award ceremony because I couldn't miss the game. I did not even receive it. Someone else collected it for me. And I'm so glad I did.
Yeah. Now, that was the game they won, right?
That was the comeback, the 6-1 comeback.
I was in the stands.
Oh, man, I wish I'd been there. I walked out, asked my girlfriend to collect my award for me. She was not happy.
That's funny. That's why she's not your wife. She's not
yeah, I haven't seen her in some time.
That's too funny. It's kind of funny because, to prepare for our conversation, I actually read the Bill of Rights this morning. And I went down to a couple ones, public property cannot be taken without just compensation. But yeah, what you are involved in is number 10, powers not delegated to the U.S. government by the Constitution are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Mm-hmm. So that's why, when you live in different states, there's a whole set of different rules
that
are decided not nationally. And that's, California has some interesting takes on what's allowable. And I very interesting, as I came in on the freeway, there's a sign that says in foreclosure, call 1-800 to keep your home. And you go, okay, well, that's interesting. Cause there's a foreclosure statute that says, well, if you're a lender and you're not getting paid, you have a right to chase the asset.
Right.
And there's a group of attorneys that say, now we'll get in the way of that. And that's
Is this California?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was another one. Now, this is a new one. And yeah. I don't see this one in California. Feeling disrespected by your boss? Call 1-800-JUSTICE.
I saw that one in Riverside. Riverside. In Riverside. Yeah.
Going, wow, that's a new one. What would be the definition of disrespected? I'm not sure.
You can file a lawsuit over anything.
Well, it's very interesting. It's I wouldn't be what I don't know. I've been involved in so little lawyer meetings in my entire life, you know, so it's been great not to have to do that. Joey mentioned that you were in the legislative session. There's 2 days remaining. What is a legislative session?
So in California, state lawmakers have a 2-year session. So after an election, they legislate for 2 years after that. So any bill has that 2-year window in which to be introduced, debated, and passed. And if they don't pass within 2 years, then a brand new session with a brand new set of bills starts right after that. So this is year one of the 2-year legislative session. It ends typically in the middle of September, which is right now, actually. Right. Anything they don't get done in the next 3 days or 2 days will either disappear entirely or have to wait until February to begin the process for the current cycle. And if it doesn't get through between now and the end of August of 2022, then it's dead. And they'll have to start from scratch in 2023.
Okay.
This is different state by state, by the way. I know you have listeners from different states. A lot of states don't have a full-time legislature that works as a career. And so they'll have, you know, a 45-day, a 60-day session where, you know, they start work and they're done in 2 months and that's it. If they didn't get it done there, unless they call an emergency session, it's their work is over with.
Okay. Well, what are some of the key topics that are under discussion that now, when you say that they get passed, mm-hmm. do they get passed into law or do they get passed to say we're going to put it up for being voted on?
Passed into law.
Passed into law. And it doesn't need the public's approval by voting at all.
Depending on what it is, if it's a constitutional amendment, then it's passed in order to place on the ballot for voters. Right.
Okay.
So Prop 19, which we sponsored last year, was that, you know, we had the legislature put the language together and we're placing it on the ballot so that the voters could approve it.
Okay.
That's about the only time that takes place. There are other cases in which the legislature may put something on the ballot for voter approval rather than try to do it on its own. But usually, you know, the vast majority of time they are debating a law, they are going to enact it. Or not.
Okay. So give me an example of what's being discussed. And then the legislator, how many legislators are actually voting for a passage of something?
We have 80 members of the state assembly, the lower house, 40 members of the Senate. You need a majority to pass most legislation unless it involves raising taxes, in which case you need a 2/3 majority for passage of those. At the moment, there is a clear supermajority of Democrats in both houses, in the Senate and the Assembly. I think out of 40 senators, I think there's only 8 Republicans at this point. In the Assembly, I think it's like 18 out of 80. So Democrats have the votes to pass anything that requires a 2/3 majority, as well as the votes to override anything a governor might veto. So if people are thinking that, you know, the governor is going to get recalled and a Republican governor could take his place and veto the bills, Democrats can override any veto. It's rare that it happens, but they can. So typically you need 41 votes in the Assembly and 21 votes in the Senate, but sometimes you need more than that, depending on what you're trying to do.
How is Prop 13 still around? If that group didn't want it around, they could literally say it's done.
No, they couldn't, because Prop 13 was passed as a constitutional amendment.
Okay. So that's a vote of the people then?
It is. So the most that the legislature could do is put it on the ballot for repeal and then send it to voters who are going to promptly slam that back in their face because voters do like Prop 13 a lot.
Apparently, yeah, it's still around after all these years.
Yeah.
When you have legislator, okay, so you said basically it's almost replicate. It's like the United States set up in a way. You have Senate and the House of Representatives. Okay. When does the governor have the right to bypass them and proclamate something into existence?
It's pretty limited. A lot less, the governor has a lot less power to enact things than the president of the United States, for instance.
Okay.
So people who are seeing things saying, if a Republican replaces Gavin Newsom, they can enact voter restrictions and limit abortion rights. Like, no, can't. Those are laws. They cannot be done by the governor. You know, the governor is not the commander in chief of the military. The governor doesn't have a bunch of emergency powers or even powers that have been delegated to him. It's much more limited. But there's certain things they can do. So under emergency scenarios, such as we saw for COVID,
right,
the governor could enact emergency mask mandates, the eviction moratorium in our world, health and safety procedures that affected all kinds of industries, again, under emergency orders. But to give you an example of some of the limits, the federal government through the CDC had its eviction moratorium active until a judge struck it down last week.
Right.
The state of California, the emergency moratorium on evictions ended 3 months after it was enacted because the courts and the governor said, legally, we can't keep this going. So since September of last year, it's been enacted by legislation, which is what the federal courts told the federal government. They said, the CDC can't do this, but if you want to have a moratorium, you can do that, but you got to go through Congress to get it done.
Okay, so the moratorium that's in place now, we're talking about four evictions?
Yes.
Is that was a federal, not a state?
There were two layers.
Okay.
So the federal moratorium by the CDC that was struck down by the courts recently, it hasn't really mattered much in California because California's eviction moratorium goes much further than what the federal government did. So,
and the California's eviction law is now over or it's still in place?
It's still in place. It's been extended three times. The most recent extension lasts until the end of September, barring an extension that could be being debated as we speak.
Okay. So if you're a property owner, you really don't have any rights to enforce. I've got to collect. And if you have a loan, is there any help on the other side? So you've made it possible for me not to collect rent for basically a year. Mm-hmm. I've had a house payment for 12 months. Can I get a break on that? How's that working?
So what should be happening, and unfortunately is not, is that the property owner in a scenario in which the tenant is affected by COVID and their income is affected by COVID and they can't pay the rent, the property owner should be whole. They should be whole today because there are billions in funds for emergency rental assistance that would cover 100% of the lost rent that started last April, running all the way through present day.
Okay.
That's if the bureaucracy worked the way it should. But we saw in California what happened with the unemployment benefits and trying to get that process through the bureaucratic systems that exist. The same things really happened with rental assistance. And we've seen a small amount of that money get out the door. We've done better, by the way, in the Inland Empire, Riverside County, San Bernardino County, City of Riverside. We fought really hard locally to have those agencies enact their own programs. Because what the state of California wanted was for the federal money that was flowing for rental assistance. They right. wanted the cities and counties to sign the back of the check, send it to the state, let the state run the whole program. We pushed locally to have the counties and the larger cities that could qualify for money enact their own programs because we wanted local accountability. You know, the ability to call up a county supervisor and say, hey, we're having a problem here, you know? And so that's worked better. Not perfect, because there are still federal guidelines and, you know, other entanglements that cause an issue. And the demand has been pretty huge, but it's worked better. So if those work well, then we shouldn't have a lot of trouble with property owners not receiving rent from one source or another.
Have you talked to the people that, let's say, manage real estate for a living, and what percentage of the people are actually not paying?
Yes. Actually, we speak on a very regular basis since early last year. every time we ask a question, the results are somewhere in the low to mid single digit percentages
that are not paying. That's correct. So,
yeah, it's frankly didn't get as bad as we thought it would.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I'm a private owner that has rental properties. And when all this hit, I called the property manager and I just told him, I said, you know what, honestly, if somebody's lost their job and really has to stay inside, let's just be cool with it. And we'll, you know, not disrupt their family and we'll work it out. You know, that's sort of like in legislation, you don't want that power taken away from you. And the assumption is we won't do the right thing. Maybe, you know, if we're the guy that owns the stuff, well, if I'm not going to pay, you're going to get kicked out. That's not exactly how we think, you know, because we probably were a tenant at some point.
Yeah. And that's what we found is that, you know, we work with small investors, small landlords. You know, our association, we don't have the big corporate Wall Street hedge fund owners of real estate as members. Our members who are property managers within brokerages or on their own are usually dealing with, you know, small mom and pops that have a handful. You know, maybe they have five or six. Usually it's one or two or three.
Right.
So if we're talking about someone, you know, some 6 or 7% of tenants not paying rent, that really means that most of these owners are getting 100% of the rents. And some of them are getting zero.
Right.
So to some of them, it's a disaster.
Right.
To most of them, it's so far, knock on wood, not too bad.
Right. Is there anything on the docket right now that's a game changer for our industry? You know, that's up for grabs for getting a yes or no answer from the legislator?
For the existing industry, I don't think so. There's some major things that we're working on that matter for the long-term affordability of housing in California. And this is, our real focus right now is trying to address housing shortage and affordability in the state. And this is just so difficult because in every discussion about what we care about as a state for 40 years, the environment, education, you know, reform of this institution or that institution, climate change, et cetera. Housing is always the silver medalist in terms of priority.
Okay.
So if whatever it is we're trying to do, it's only going to add another $5,000, you know, solar panel mandate, it's only going to add another $8,000 or $10,000 to a house. Houses are $500,000. So who cares? You know, we're going to add this tax. Well, it's only going to add another $500. And what's happened is we haven't built enough. So we're trying to find a way to reimpose affordability at a market level for middle-class homeowners in the state of California who are just being shut out at this point.
When people are shut out, as in, there's no way they're going to qualify for what's currently available. Mm-hmm. What do? They just stay as renters or do they migrate elsewhere?
That's not, I think, entirely clear, especially not in the last 18 months, because the habits and the ability of people to move changed a lot after COVID. What happens when things normalize, whatever normalized looks like, is a different issue. Because if you look at what happened since COVID, you had an immediate market shutdown in March and early April of last year, in which people had no idea what the heck was going on.
Right.
Followed by we can come back and we can sell real estate. The industry's been declared essential. Followed by all the stimulus money, which created a ton of demand. Followed by people getting told by their employers, you're going to be able to work from home, especially higher income earners. And we don't anticipate coming back anytime soon, which allowed people to pick up and move hundreds of miles, if not thousands of miles, from where their current residence was for their job, which has put strain on places like Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, Idaho, you know, all these places that are getting, you know, even if it's a small percentage, we're not talking about a mass exodus of Californians, but if a small percentage of Californians decide to move into these areas that are far smaller than the areas are leaving, it puts real pressure on affordability. And we've seen that happen in small places. The Coachella Valley has been going crazy for the past year.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody leaving California, like a long distance is, let's say, San Jose to Austin. So you have some companies that are opening places in Austin. Well, there are people moving from San Jose whose homes are worth $1,500 a foot.
Yeah.
Going into Austin where everything looks like it's on sale.
Right.
And it has changed the market pretty radically to the point where my son-in-law and daughter live in Austin, and in their neighborhood, it went from 300 to 600 and there was nothing for sale. And so a property went up for sale for 600 and the winning bid was 850. What?
Right. Because those numbers don't mean anything if you're selling a, you know, $2 million house.
Exactly. You still think it's on sale.
Yeah. It's like, this is fantastic. I get a, you know, 3/4 acre, you know, the suburbs of Texas City.
The last year and a half for real estate has just been one of the most amazing times because, you know, me and I pay attention to statistics. 2019, the entire year, had the best set of statistics I've ever seen that make a boom in price happen, and it didn't happen. And then you get into the coronavirus happening, what, about March? Mm-hmm. And half of the listings are pulled off, you know, of the MLS. So your inventory went down by 50%. People are saying, there's no way you're going to tour my house. And that what happened is, I think some of those people thought, you know what, I get to have a chance to refi and a mortgage that starts with a 2. And since we're going to work at home now, why don't we add an office or something? And they just, I think a lot of that inventory, I'm not sure it's coming back. They just said, to heck with it. We're good. You know?
Yeah. I'm kind of out of the predictions business right now.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
We bought a house last April. So we bought a house in San Diego. I still have my home in Riverside. But we've been wanting to buy a home in San Diego for a while. On March 5th, we made the offer. COVID lockdown happened about 4 days later. And we've been looking in this neighborhood for a little while. The seller said, well, let me see what other offers we get. And then the lockdown happened, and seller, like within about an hour, said, we'll take it. And at that point, we took a step back and thought, boy, what do we do here? I mean, you know, what's going to happen? And what ultimately convinced us was, well, two things. One is that there was this weekend, because at that time, interest rates were like 3.5. And this weekend where interest rates plummeted, and we got locked in at 2.78, I think.
Right. Okay.
So that was number one. Number two was, we weren't buying a house in order to sell it 5 years from now or 3 years from now. We're going to be here for 30 years. I don't care if it goes down 30% next year. They're not building single family homes in San Diego anymore. It's not a thing. And if you look around the state in urban environments, they're not building single family neighborhoods. They're building more densely. So the new housing is going to be multifamily. So single family homes, you know, that's something that I think you can stick with. Long-term.
Yeah. You know what? Well, what's interesting about inflation. So, you know, if you're in the building business, you notice lumber went crazy and some other things too.
Yeah.
When you own a residence or you own a rental, it's made of commodities.
Yeah.
And there's always a correlation between a new house value and an existing home value. And only 4 times, by the way, have existing homes been more per square foot than new. And you're at it right now. I looked at a report last night, and it goes back many, many years, and you've only intersected about 4 times in history, and we're at one of them.
And I have no idea what to do with that data right now.
Well, what's interesting about, well, what it says is that you can't buy a new house because it doesn't exist. So all the demand lands on existing inventory. So if you look at the car data, how many counties have more than 20 days of inventory? None. I mean, how many have more than 10? I don't even think there's any of that. Last time I looked, it was 7. Was like, oh my gosh, you know? And so I don't know how you solve that. That's crazy that you've been under building too. So that's the, when you think about 1 year under building, so a typical boom cycle ends at 150,000 single family homes. you progress up there from 50 or 60 to that number. We didn't make that progress. We took that 8-year period and did 50,000 each year. So if you add the cumulative missing homes, it's many hundreds of thousands of homes that weren't thought necessary, or was the process was so frustrating that they just said, you know what, we'll go to Florida or Texas and build some.
You know, the most challenging thing that we run into when we're trying to make sense of legislation and legislative initiatives in California is that there is a belief among some lawmakers, but really among their young staffs, you know, their young staffs that just came out of Ivy Leagues, who don't feel that supply and demand, it should be a factor in housing. As if you get to choose that, you know, as if that's a decision you can make, that supply and demand isn't going to matter, right? And we have to constantly push back and show you can trace a straight correlation between how many houses are available for sale and what the price increase or decrease is year over year over just about any period of time. You know, there's hiccups here and there, but you can look at 2008 when in this region, Inland Empire had like 120,000 listings and 20,000 sales. prices fell through the floor. And then years where you see significant increase, you'll have 40,000 listings and 40,000 sales.
What's interesting about what you just said, there's another chart that plays where that. So in 2008 and 2009, you had all this inventory, but it was predominantly owned by lenders.
Yes.
It dictated the market price. It had nothing to do with the cost of construction.
Right.
It had to do with there's 10 buyers and there's 100 houses. So you're going to get it for nothing. And that was, you know, that's definitely the opposite is right now. If you have something for sale, you're going to get pretty shocked. You mentioned Joshua Tree. There was a gentleman, we just had a boot camp in Florida where we had some California investors wanting to do some exchanges. And he sold his 500 square foot house in 29 Palms for $200,000, $400 a foot. And he probably paid $25,000 for it or something, you know, just going, oh my gosh. So yeah, the supply and demand, even though California is losing migration, they haven't overbuilt. So you still have a housing shortage, and it's, I don't know how that changes.
I don't know either. You know, I mean, we passed two bills in the last 2 weeks, which freaked out some folks, SB9 and SB10.
Okay.
Because both of them allow for much higher density to be built on single family lots.
Right.
SB10, if you're in a transit neighborhood, which doesn't include hardly anything in Inland Empire, but if you're by a ferry terminal or a high frequency train stop, you know, where you have a train every 10 minutes, certain very, very high frequency bus stops, you can now build, you know, take that single family lot. Usually you're gonna have to compile a couple of these, and you can build dense multifamily 10 to the acre and reduce parking requirements, with the idea being that you're talking about San Diego, you're talking about San Jose, San Francisco, trying to build up these areas that need more density. And then SB9 that we passed last week, the headline was the end of single family zoning, because it allows lot splits. You can take a single family lot, if it meets certain criteria, split it, make two lots. And because of ADU laws, you can build a main home and an ADU. So now the single family lot becomes a 4-unit lot, potential lot, going forward. Yeah. Now, only about 4 to 5% of lots in California meet the criteria for this lot split. But there was a lot of pushback. We actually negotiated some of the changes in the bill. So one of the things we negotiated in the bill was the person who did the lot split had to be an owner occupant who signed an affidavit saying that they would live there for at least 3 years afterwards. So that we wanted owners to benefit, not someone buying a bunch of lots and not living with the results. And then we gave cities a little bit more power to, you know, to vet health and safety and other things. But here's what we're running into. You're talking about trying to catch up to the home ownership or home inventory issue. Mm-hmm. What we're constantly having to do right now is find a way to build housing affordably. which is a different problem than building affordable housing. Building affordable housing for lower income families means getting a bunch of tax money and subsidizing it, right? And what is extraordinarily frustrating about that is just how much subsidy it takes to build a single unit. I was just talking to the chairman of the board of supervisors in San Bernardino County. They're trying to build housing to take homeless individuals off the streets. And a single unit, essentially a one-bedroom efficiency, is costing them, when you get through all the bureaucracy, all the programs, about $550,000.
Wow.
For a single unit to build. This is, there's no profit margin. This is being built by nonprofit organizations.
Right.
All there is trying to navigate the red tape, going through all the environmental requirements, everything that California does to make it hard to build. So that's the affordable housing conundrum, is how do we try to make it easier so the dollars go further? The housing affordability conundrum is a different issue. This is, how do we build market housing so that you can accommodate a middle-class earner so that they can afford what's being built? Like, even if there was zero profit margin today, the median income in the region is about $65,000.
Right.
If you do the math, you end up with, they can afford about $2,000 a month, right? Roughly for their housing. You know, that's an affordable figure. You're talking about a $300,000 house, roughly, right? You can't build a $300,000 house. It's not a thing that you can do in the region.
I'm not even sure the rent's $2,000 right now.
No.
It might be more.
Yeah. Now, you know, curiously, you go look at Utah, Texas, Oregon, Arizona, you can build a $300,000 house. You can do it, you know, but not here.
We do it all the time in Florida. We have, you know, that's part of what we do. And it's definitely, it's kind of eye-opening because of the land availability and the process. Up until the coronavirus, the process was just very easy. Coronavirus has changed a few things.
See isurvivedrealestate.com for event details, information on all our generous sponsors, and to connect with our speakers.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.